What's going on, guys? I am Sailor Smurf, and welcome to the On Deck Podcast. We have a really cool one here for you guys today. It was recorded about a year and a half ago, before we had the studio and before I ran off to go work on some other projects before I could circle back around to this, hence the delay in getting this published. But it's a really cool episode. It's myself and Stephen Lloyd, co-owner of the Yacht Rigger, talking all things rigging inspections. And it's just, yeah, it's great. As I said, though, it is before the studio. Audio's a little bit echoey, so sorry for that, but definitely worth a listen. And this is the kind of stuff that I wish that I had access to as I was just getting into the boating world. He just demystifies so many aspects of boat life as it pertains to your rigging. So let's not delay any further and go ahead and roll it. So we're here today talking about all things rigging. And just to back things up a little bit, what is rigging on a boat?
Good question. Just,
I mean, that's a good simple place as to start. That is.
Yeah. Right. So we break rigging down into two areas, standing rigging and running rigging. Your standing rigging is the wires, or we call them shrouds and stays, that you see that hold the mast up. So standing rigging is anything and everything involved with keeping the mast upright. Go so far as even your chain plates are considered part of your standing rigging. Well, they're kind of a dual role, I guess. They're part of the construction of the boat as well as the component that the standing rigging is attached to. And then running rigging is all the lines. Remember, there's no ropes on the boat, but all the lines that are run up and through the mast or have anything to do with sail control or positioning the mast, even if they're running backs. So standing rigging, okay, though, is typically the most common perception of what rigging is.
Okay. So you have the cables, or I guess there's rod rigging too, right? But all like that's the rigid stuff is standing.
Correct.
And then anything that's maybe moving or made out of a rope material?
Sure. I mean, if you want to use terms like dynamic, like things that move around, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So anything that is moving around is part of your running rigging. And then, yeah, and I guess it's how much does it move, right? Because your standing rigging, if you think about it, right, one of our enemies is cyclical loading or cyclical movements. And so the standing rigging is moving. It just moves a whole lot less than any of the running rigging that you move the sails around with the running rigging, and the mast is the framework that is supported by the standing rigging.
Wow, fascinating. So standing rigging, running rigging. All right, so if we think about rig inspections, I know that was something that we wanted to cover today.
Yeah.
Who's that important for? Why would you get a rig inspection? Are there different categories of people and why that would matter to them?
Sure. So I guess the first answer is who should get a rigging inspection would be everyone who owns a sailboat, whether it's 3 months old or 30 years old, especially so if it's 30 years old, but even someone who has just purchased a sailboat, there's components and issues that can occur that we fairly frequently do even see on newer boats that should be addressed. And it's not necessarily to blame the manufacturer or the commissioner, but things can get missed. A cotter pin, for instance, that secures a clevis pin could be not bent correctly or forgotten. I've seen missing cotter pins on boats that were a few months old, and that's a critical component that holds the rig up and keeps everything secure.
And the cotter, so you have like those little pins that go, you're talking about that small pin that goes through the bigger pin, right?
Correct, yes. So the cotter pin is the small pin that holds the big solid clevis pin in place. The clevis pin is what attaches the shroud or stay, the standing rigging, to the mast or deck. And so those could be missing. That's one of the important things to look for during a rigging inspection, and why age doesn't matter. If that thing's missing on a brand new boat or on a boat that is 20 years old, it's still going to cause a failure.
Is there a trick between clevis pins and carter pins like there is for stalactites and stalagmites? I, for the life of me, 4 months into being a apprentice yacht rigger, cannot sailboat rigger, I always invert those.
That's a very good question.
Have you ever heard of one? I just wondered if that was
there's,
you have to think back to your youth.
We need to come up with one.
Yeah, right.
I'm gonna write that down for March.
Yeah, if anyone has any good way of remembering the difference between the carter pin and the clevis pin, yeah, absolutely. We have a number in the show notes. Call into that, let us know,
please.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
When you're buying a boat, where does rigging inspections play into that? And is that covered whenever you get your regular, what do you call the boat survey?
The boat survey. So yes and no. Some surveyors, and there's some good ones out there, will do a rigging inspection as part of the survey, but they're a dying breed. Is I can think of two or three that I know of, and we recommend when people ask us about surveyors who go aloft and look at everything and also know what they're doing, because we get to see the reports a lot of the time, because a surveyor will flag items, but they don't necessarily know what it costs or what's involved to repair those. So we tend to hear from that secondhand from the good surveyors. And then if your surveyor does not go aloft, which is very important, you should be hiring a rigger wherever you are to get the rigging inspection done and have someone climb up the mast and inspect it from top to bottom, because it's obviously a very important part of your sailboat.
Okay. So, and when they're doing inspection, part of a rigging inspection is, because I could see a surveyor being like, yeah, I checked out your rigging, and he walked around the deck.
Sure.
Do you have to go aloft up the mast to really
100%. Yes. Okay. And so looking around the deck level, you're only seeing, let's call it 20% of what's involved, because you can't see any of the pins more than 10 feet off the deck. You can't see what the masthead electrical looks like. You can't see what any of the shivs, which a shiv is a pulley, you can't see what any of those look like. You can't see what the spreaders look like or any of the shroud connections on the mast. So there's a lot more to a rigging inspection than just glancing at the shrouds and feeling their tension, which is what we see people do fairly frequently.
Okay. Yeah, that seems like a pretty good way to... I could just see having boat surveys done and people like, oh, yeah, you know, I kind of checked it out. It's like, well, sure. I mean, it's going to be pretty obvious if you got this whole chair out, slung yourself up the mast or not. You're not going to miss that if you're there for the survey.
You would know for sure. Yeah, absolutely. The person going up the mast is usually the most exciting part of of a survey. If someone does that, everyone, that's when the cameras come out.
Yeah, yeah, right. And people on the docks, you know, you see them poking their heads out under their biminis.
We see it every day.
Yeah. That is funny. You get to be a little bit of entertainment for everybody.
You've probably got to experience at least some of that in the last few months.
Yeah. They have they're having their sundowners, you know, and you're up the rig there. And yeah, it is funny. It's also funny. I like being able, if I see someone who I know their name and I call out to them, they look everywhere but up. It takes them a while.
It always, like,
where
it's the
is
last
that coming
place.
From? Yeah. You don't think to look up. I mean, it's like people are flying around. That's weird.
Yeah.
So yeah, I like doing that.
Yeah. So you would know for sure. So, and it shouldn't just be a 5-minute event. You know, if the person goes up the mast and gets to the top and then zips their way down with barely glancing at anything, that's not necessarily a good thing, because we're looking at a true rigging inspection. You're taking your time. You're looking at every component, every fitting, looking for very fine hairline cracks, looking for correct angles on shroud attachments, looking for broken strands in the wire, corrosion points mid-wire. So there's a lot of nuance to it, really. And unfortunately, there's not a clear guideline, because every mast and every boat is so different. So the rigger needs to be fairly adept or knowledgeable to begin with in order to find potential issues.
It's like if your boat is, you know, if the engine's not running well, you know, that's a thing, you know, your electronics aren't working, your chart plot or whatever.
It's clear.
You know, also it's an inconvenience, but it's probably not going to kill you if your, you know, chart plotter isn't working or whatever, your AC isn't working.
Right.
There's a real safety aspect to a rig. It's not just about, oh, I need to get a rig inspection so I know how much it's going to cost me later to replace it, or what I'm in for on this boat, use it as a point of negotiation. Right. Can you talk to the safety aspect of, especially saying you're buying a boat and you're about to sail away in it? I mean,
it's one of the questions we ask people a lot is, can you imagine what it's like to have this entire apparatus fall down at 2 a.m. when it's dark and blowing 20 knots and their sails attached to it? Or even less scarily so, even 2 miles out in the bay when it's blowing 12 knots, these things happen and people get hurt no matter what. It's a very large structure that has a lot of moving parts with a boom attached to it, and typically sails. And people have been killed by either the falling structure itself or getting pinned under the sails or knocked into the water. It's a huge safety issue, and it's typically not the kind of thing that gives you a lot of warning. So when a cap shroud or an upper shroud, one of the main shrouds that holds the mast up, fails, you don't really have a whole lot of options. The mast will quite often just break and fall over in a couple pieces, or the whole thing will come down. So same thing with a forestay or a headstay. If those things fail under load, it's coming down. There's not a strong chance that you can do anything about it. Like an engine stopping working, you got time to react. Or your chart plotter going out, you can, you know, do some dead reckoning and figure out where you got to go. It's a critical component that quite often will be a complete deal breaker, trip ender, boat ride off situation if you're anywhere remotely offshore. So it's a big deal.
Yeah, that definitely sounds like a big deal. What about, what would you say? All right, so I hear this and I truly don't know the answer. My rig is 10 years old. Do I have to replace it? Is there something magic about 10 years between insurance, or like what's the deal with
this
that?
This is kind of like the anchor debate. Which is the best anchor?
Oh, interesting.
So we have a policy at the Yacht Rigger that boats in our area, which is not quite tropical, but it's hot, it's sunny, salty, warm weather. 15 years is the maximum. We typically shy away from even doing a rigging inspection if we know the rigging is 15 years or older. And the reason for that is we've seen failures fairly commonly on anything older than 15 years old. We've found failed parts that hadn't completely failed yet, but cracked swages, broken strands, fairly commonly on boats that the rigging is 12 to 14 years old. Multi-hulls, that's a little different. On catamarans and trimarans, we typically see failures a little earlier because the cyclical loading or shock loading is more significant, because when a monohull comes into a gust of wind, it leans over. When a catamaran experiences a gust of wind, it powers up. So that rigging works harder. And so I've fairly frequently on 8 to 10 year old catamaran rigging found cracked swages or broken wire strands. So I guess if I were to sum it up, depending on location, somewhere between 10 and 15 years is the cutoff point. I've experienced working in the islands where I did my apprenticeship, and out there in the Caribbean, those boats, we've fairly frequently, or a lot more frequently, found failed rigging in the 10-year range. And so the life expectancy out there in the islands, the going, air quotes here, the standard was roughly 10 years old, was time to replace it.
Why would the Caribbean be different?
It's hotter, and the tropical weather seems to be more aggressive and cause more or faster corrosion. I don't actually know the science behind that. It's a good question.
Yeah, that's interesting. Just a harsher environment, yep, one way or another.
Exactly. I guess one other aspect, and this is just occurring to me now as I think about it, a lot of the boats that arrive in the islands have done serious mileage. And so you got boats that have just done crossings from Europe, and they're hardcore cruisers. So they're really putting lots and lots of miles in. The people on the Florida coast here, a lot of people are only sailing their boats every month for a weekend. And so the sea miles and the cyclical loading is significantly lower.
So I know you're not an insurance adjuster, but is it true that you could not be bothered by your insurance, have a rig that's more than 10 years old, that rig fail, and then insurance do their due diligence, their background checking, and find out that your rig was older than 10 years and it was in the policy that it needed to be replaced at 10 years, and you lose coverage because of that? Like, have you ever seen that in a policy?
Never seen someone lose coverage. I've seen insurance companies depreciate the rig and rigging significantly. Mm. So we had a client with a boat that was, I believe, 18 years old, and he lost his rig just out sailing in the bay. The replacement cost, that's for round numbers sake, the rig and the boom and the sails, everything was roughly $25,000. And I remember him getting a check for somewhere in the $7,000 or $8,000 region. And so that really hurt. He was very unhappy, just the depreciation surprise. And what they told him, or what he told me, this is all secondhand, but what they told him was that if he had had annual inspections done, they would have had, it was like a sliding scale, like he would have got a little more money. But there was a clause in the policy that said 100% coverage only mattered if your rigging was 10 years or younger, 10 years old or younger.
That's interesting. Okay. Yeah. And it's not, it doesn't seem like it needs a ton of attention. It's when they say annually, what did they literally mean, every year?
Yeah. So
that's what that particular,
we're seeing it more and more. So yeah, clients are contacting us and saying, hey, I need a written report from a rigging company saying we've done an inspection. And that it's as simple as a one-page report where we specify each portion of the rigging. For instance, the standing rigging, the running rigging, the condition of the spar, the spreaders, the tune. So how well tuned the rig is. And it's a very simple document that we send to them, and that gets them their insurance renewal.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So what is something that someone, what would you prescribe or recommend for people who are wanting to at least be able to look at their own rig to ascertain, I mean, nothing professional, nothing like that, but what are some things that you would tell a friend or family member to look for on their rig if they're out in the middle of the sure. ocean and they're wondering, hey, is this thing safe? I feel like it's doing X, Y, Z. What might you tell them to look for?
So I'm a firm believer that everyone who owns a boat should be moderately competent at inspecting their own rigging. And it's simply a case of education. And we try and educate as many of our clients who want to learn this on what to look for. It's fairly simple in that you're looking for the cotter and clevis pins, once we figure out how to remember what those are, to be in place and be secure. So you want to be sure that the rigging is firmly attached. And so I typically, when I do an inspection, I go all the way up to the top and I start at the top and I work my way down. And it's a systematic approach where you look at every component. And in terms of safety, we should focus on standing rigging for now, because there's also electrical components to look at. So you could start looking for corrosion on lights and wiring that's chafing or damaged. But if we focus on the standing rigging, you want to make sure all the pins are secure. Then you want to become familiar with your swage fittings, whether they're mechanical fittings, which we should talk about at some point, or swage fittings. Swage fittings have a habit of cracking because they're compressed under an extreme amount of load when they are formed by the swage machine. So you need to look at those very closely. That's where we typically find cracks. And the cracks run counterintuitively. They run along the load path, not across the load path. So what I mean by that is the crack typically runs vertically along the long length of the swage. And I had an engineer explain to me that that's called the hot dog effect. And it's an engineering, It's a common test question in engineering classes. Why, when you throw a hot dog on the grill, it doesn't split across the short axis. They always explode on the long axis. And there's literally an engineering principle there that I don't understand, but it applies in rigging.
So that is fascinating.
It's really crazy. And we see it every week in the field where you find cracked swages, and they always crack the same way. So very fine hairline cracks. And you have to be a little aware that the dies that smash or squish the fitting onto the wire, they leave lines that are very, very straight on the swage fitting. So those, don't let those freak you out, but you're looking for little running cracks that run up the length of the swage. So that's one thing. And then the obvious one that people pick up very easily, and the one we get called about most commonly, is if a strand is broken in your wire, that's really bad. There's a reason for that, and it's either way past its age or it's seen some incredible load. That's an immediate cause for replacement. So that one is fairly obvious, but you want to look closely and see if there aren't any that are starting to fail. And then the other close place to look would be the spreaders, where the spreaders are attached to the mast itself and where the wires pass through the spreaders. That is an area that failures can occur. The last place would be the deck level, where everything attaches to the deck. So where the turnbuckles are, there are typically toggles with another set of clevis and cotter pins that are attached to the deck. Those can be cotter pins can be ripped out or partially straightened by sheets or feet, shoes, anything really that bumps up against them, a whisker pole, if the cotter pin were to fall out, and then the lee side goes a little slack while you're sailing, the clevis pin can simply fall out so that you tack over and the mast falls down. So a systematic step-by-step visual inspection of every component. It should take you, on a simple boat, 45 minutes to look at everything, maybe longer when you're a little less experienced.
Yeah, that seems reasonable. It's funny. It feels like people know the exact specs on their serpentine belt, or they know exactly what the engine needs, and they know every little factory setting and available function of their multifunction display.
Right.
But the rig is a giant mystery.
Yeah.
And there's really no reason, I can say, as someone who's being taught how these rigs work and all of this by professional riggers, there's no reason for it to be some great mystery.
I mean, there's lots of good information out there. Yeah,
right.
Selden, for instance, has an amazing rigging. I think it's called the Rig Tuning Guide
I think that sounds right. Yeah. Rig Tuning Guide. It's something like that. I'll see if they'll let me link that in the show notes.
That'd be great.
Oh my gosh. If I knew about that when I was trying to figure out where to even get started with knowing my rigging and just familiarizing myself.
Hints and advice. I think it's called Hints and Advice.
Yeah.
By Selden.
And when I talked to a guy at Selden, who we were working one of the trade shows with, Boat Expo with, he had mentioned that they had been building that manual for like 30 years.
They constantly edit and update.
Yeah.
And refine it. It's an amazing thing. And it's one of the things that we send out to anyone who's starting with us and say, hey, please read this because it will get you so far ahead in terms of terminology, as well as the basic principles of how and why shrouds are attached where they are.
Yeah. Difference between a head stay and a fore stay. You know, exactly. You want to know those differences. Exactly. I made flashcards. I made like 50 flashcards out of that. I think it's like 30 some odd pages. Don't quote me. Something like that. Okay. Here's a question that will definitely rile up some feedback, I'm sure.
Controversial.
I know, right? So controversial here. The using tape, like rigger's tape, around the turnbuckles to hold in the cotter pins. That was actually 50-50 because now I'm all confused in my head. I could have gone either way.
Right.
I don't know how I don't know that in 4 months. I just dyslexify those two words. So tape to you? Should you put tape around that? It just seems ubiquitous. It doesn't matter what YouTube video I'm watching and people who know their stuff really well, but I always see them taped up and I'm starting to understand, you know, maybe you shouldn't do that. What say you?
So I'm fine with tape as long as it's temporary. I'm fine with tape for a passage and then you remove it when you get to your place of anchorage. I'm fine with tape for a series of races as long as it comes off when you're done. The reason for that is tape causes corrosion. It's a blinder, so you can't see whether or not there's a pin there once there's tape in place. So you might know for sure that your pins are there, but if you hire someone to do a rigging inspection and they're just to assume that there's pins under there, sometimes you can feel them, but not always. It depends on the construction of the turnbuckle, but mostly it accelerates corrosion. So we come across rigging inspections every once in a while where tape has been just left on and it's crusty and just been collecting dirt for years and years and years. And it's just been eating away at the turnbuckle body or the swage stud that's directly below it.
Yeah, just holding salt up against it and water evaporates out, salt's left.
No oxygen.
Eating at it.
Yep, it's oxygen deprived.
Yeah,
stainless needs oxygen to form an oxalic layer. It long-term, tape is bad. Short term, I'm perfectly fine with it because it does serve a purpose. If you're, especially for racers or boats that have a really aggressive inboard or sheathing angle that the sheets run right alongside the turnbuckles and you don't want to get snagged, it makes sense. But it's so easy and cheap to just apply it and remove it at the end of a passage that it just makes perfect sense.
You'd also mention a couple of terms. And so to circle back on those, you mentioned briefly about mechanical fittings and swaged fittings?
Sure.
Yeah. What are the differences? I know that both of those pertain to the standing rigging. What are those?
So there's a couple names out there that people use generically with mechanical fittings, and you may have heard those, or a lot of listeners may have heard those in the past. People will refer to them as, oh, I have Norseman fittings on my rig, or I have Stay-Lock fittings on my rig. Occasionally you'll hear Hi-Mod, which is less well known, but all of those are mechanical compression fittings that can be installed in the field. And they're designed specifically so that people can install components on the end of their rigging without the need for a expensive swage machine. So for example, the swage machine we have in our shop is $20,000. Your average sailor is not going to want to buy that machine and stick it in his garage so he can re-rig his boat one time. Not really something you'd want to do. So the mechanical fitting is, and we can post a link in the notes.
For sure.
To a graphic that shows how they go together, but it's typically the wire is made up of layers, and so there's a central core to the wire on your mast, and so the 1x19 wire construction is, there's 19 individual strands. That's what 1x19 means. So there's a center core wire, and then there's two opposing rotated layers of wires that surround that single strand. And the total is 19. So what typically happens with a mechanical fitting is the outer layer is unwound, and a wedge, or there's different names for it, but let's call it a wedge. A wedge is slid onto the center, and Well, first, actually, there's a component I should back up. The first part of the fitting is slid over the wire. Then you open up the outer layers and slide the wedge in place, close the layers back over the wedge, and then form the fitting together. And this is something that you almost have to be shown. It's very hard to explain.
Yeah.
But the main principle here is that that fitting is designed to be installed onto the wire anywhere in the field. You could do it on the deck of your boat with some dexterity and tools. And you could essentially replace a shroud if you had a coil of wire and a couple of compression fittings or mechanical fittings with you. A misconception about those that we come across all the time is someone will say, hey, I've got Norsemans and my rig is 18 years old. Can you reuse my Norsemans? Because I've heard they're reusable and that should save me a bunch of money on my re-rig. And my answer to that is usually, well, 18 years from now, that's going to be some 36-year-old stainless steel that's holding your mast up. And these fittings, they weren't designed to be reused. They were designed to be installed in the field. Now, if you had some damage to a wire, to a portion of your stay after 7 or 8 years, sure, I would happily reuse that fitting. But 15 years on, I'm not comfortable using that stainless steel to hold your mast up when the guys that designed it have said to my face, those things were not designed to be reused. They were designed as field insulation fittings. So that's a very long-winded way, I guess, of explaining what a mechanical fitting is. Then there's a swage fitting, and that is simply a fitting for the end of the wire that is slipped over the rigging wire, the 1x19, and then we run it through that $20,000 machine I was mentioning with some dies that compress the fitting onto the wire, and it compresses it so hard that if you cut that section after compressing it, it looks 98% solid. You can barely make out the wire that was originally pushed inside.
So that's all the components that hold up the mast, right? So you have your standing rigging and the health of it, making sure that it's being inspected, doing everything you need to do to, A, not let it be this elusive, mysterious, nebulous force in your life, but
correct.
Go through the, just do a little bit of homework to learn exactly what this thing is and, you know, how to make sure that it's staying healthy.
Demystify the mast.
Demystify, yes. Yeah, there you go.
If you
good
think
word.
About the mast as a large pole that is stood up on your boat and it's being held and supported at varying angles by different pieces of wire, that's essentially what it is. And all you need to do is familiarize yourself with how those fittings attach to the mast and deck.
Right. Yeah. You're not doing the calculations on, you're not designing it. You're just figuring out how to
correct.
Keep it healthy. Is it healthy? At the very least, you're just doing inspections to make sure that it's safe.
Exactly.
So what about the actual mast itself? The thing that is physically being held up by the standing rigging.
Sure.
What if your mast is 30 years old? When
right.
do you ever need a mast replacement?
Very common question. And it's usually the answer is no, simply no. The mast is aluminum. It may be oxidized in some areas. Aluminum, unless there is a significant electrolysis situation going on where there's literally a wire that is bleeding electricity into the mast, eating it away through anodic corrosion, which we will cover it's an entire topic in and of itself. Unless you have some serious underlying conditions, it's very, very rare. I've seen it happen once where a mast was severely, severely corroded at the deck collar where a keel step mast passes down through the deck and sits on the keel and then has the deck area, the deck collar is what supports that panel of the mast, and it had just corroded horribly to where it was half the thickness it used to be, and you could actually poke a screwdriver through the mast wall. It's incredibly rare, though. Occasionally, spreaders need to be replaced, especially if they're wooden, but an aluminum spreader, it's rare to see that need to be replaced unless it's like hit a bridge or something goofy like that. Like the aluminum and the mast itself tends to be perfectly fine. It's just the components within the mast, like shivs or tangs, that should be looked at.
So having looked at our rigging inspections and the age of the rig, just being aware of a lot of those different components, what about actually getting the most amount of performance out of your rig? And when would you know it's time to tune a rig?
Sure. So for most cruisers, the answer is going to be very infrequently if it's done right. You would, after you replace your standing rigging and it's tuned appropriately, sometimes depending on the way the rig was designed, a lot of rigs are more over-specced than others. But if a rig is, I don't want to say under-specced, but less over-specced, you can experience some stretch in the brand new wire up to 1%, which over a large length on a non-stretchy object results in a fair bit of elongation or the impression of slack, which it really is. So typically 3 to 6 months or a really hard sale after a re-rig, once your rig has been appropriately tuned, a follow-up tune is necessary, and then it should be good for years. The indicator that would tell you that, hey, I should probably have my rig tune addressed would be you're sailing along and the lee shrouds, so the unloaded shrouds on that side of the boat are just flopping around. Like if you can hear metal rattling, like if you can hear the toggles that the pins are in making noise, that's too loose. We see that. And or the shroud is just kind of flopping around and looks like wet spaghetti. Another strong indicator and the true way to gauge it is under sail in 12 to 15 knots of breeze on a broad reach or a close reach. If you walk up to your mast, make your way up there and look up the back of the mast, up the track, the mast should look straight. If it looks like it's wavy or falling off in certain areas, it's not staying in column when it should be. Now, if you had full sail up in 20 knots and it was falling off, that's because you're overloading the rig and stretching, overloading the wires, stressing out the boat, possibly even, moving bulkheads around. You could be, really loading the boat up on a multi-hull for sure. You're just flexing the boat. But under normal, healthy sailing conditions, the mast should be straight. And that's the true test. So when we do a sail tune, when we go out on the boat and tune it under sail, the very first thing we do is get the sails up, get on a broad reach, maybe a bit of a close reach, 60, 70 degrees off the wind, go up and look up the mast and check if it's straight. If it's not, we make adjustments. And it's a fairly long or nuanced art getting the mast straight, knowing how much to tighten each particular shroud. But essentially, everything is almost a cascade. So as you, if the very top of the mast is falling off, you simply adjust the shroud that attaches to the upper section of the mast. That's probably your cap shroud. Or if it's discontinuous rig, then that would be a different component. You would have to check out the Selden guide to know what I'm even talking about for discontinuous rigging. That's a very involved explanation. But you would be adjusting the shrouds on the mast to straighten that pole up. Like I talked about earlier, it's just a vertical pole. Now, if you have a slightly more racy mast with a lot of pre-bend, like the mast bends fore and aft, looks kind of like a bow and arrow bow, not that extreme, but that version of it, you would also look for continuous, consistent curve. And so if it was pumping back and forth, and so kind of like straightening and bending and straightening and bending, that wouldn't be good. And you would want to make some adjustments to the shrouds there. And really, it's probably something that I think any listener should have a good rigger get on the boat, give you a coaching session, and explain to you why they're adjusting what they're adjusting. And you'll learn a heck of a lot about how your rig works by spending an hour or two with a rigger who can just say, hey, we're going to adjust this shroud now because this panel looks a little loose or is slightly out of column. Same thing applies to forestay and backstay. So under sail, forestay should be relatively straight. If your luff is just really sagging and curving, you're going to suffer in upwind performance, especially heavy wind.
That is super good advice. Having someone come on the boat to help you with that, like you used the term earlier, demystifying that, that would be money so well spent. I would feel so much better having a grasp on how that stuff works. Having no sailing background at all, being brought on to the yacht riggers and being an apprentice yacht rigger, I have a sailboat rigger. I have come to a point where it's really, really empowering to be able to look up at a rig and have an idea staring up at the mast, what's happening, if you see that S-bend, how you would take that out, the difference between a forward lower and an aft lower and
right,
and what that's going to do to the rig right, or versus your intermediate, your caps.
Sure.
It's and incredible.
The beauty
it's
of,
so cool to know.
Of being taught on your own boat is you don't have to learn how every rig works. You have to learn how your rig works. And so for someone like you right now who's doing an apprenticeship and you're learning, I don't know how many different types of rigs, right? Like, I mean, we're on different boats every day and it's very different and much more complex trying to do what you're trying to do compared to someone having a rigger come out and just teach them their specific boat, because
Man, totally.
It's a much more one-dimensional situation, we should say.
Yeah, you get educated in that and you're done. Yeah,
right,
you
don't exactly need to know. If you ever sell your boat and launch another one, you know what to do. You hire a rigger again, you have them come out. And frankly, if a rigger is uncomfortable teaching you about it, find another rigger. Because you may come across that where someone's hesitant to spend the extra time and teach you. Obviously, you would want to, you know, pay the rigger for his time, but if someone doesn't want to teach you, it's either because they are uncomfortable teaching or don't know well enough how to teach you, and you should have someone teach you who is completely comfortable and can explain those things.
Yeah, that's a good filter question when you're looking for that rigger to come out and help you out.
Absolutely.
Hey, would you mind showing me what it is that you're learning here, so that, or what it is that you're doing here, so I can have a grasp on what's going on?
Like a screening tool for who you're hiring.
Exactly. Because if they're uncomfortable with it, it's totally cool. A lot of reasons, whatever. Sure. But find the next person, because the more you can be educated. And when we are going on customer boats and stuff, I always like when the customer is there, because, you know, they're spending the time to learn about their systems, what makes the boat work.
Yes.
To me, if you want to be, especially if you're ever going anywhere where you're not going to, land's not going to be visible anymore.
Right.
You do the due diligence to get yourself educated.
Right.
And I know, at least for us at the Outrigger, we love showing people how their boat works.
An educated client is the best. I mean, it's it helps everyone out long term. Mm. They ask better questions, they know part names, and it helps everyone. And I guess when I say if your rigger doesn't want to explain to you, I don't want that to seem like a common thing.
Sure.
In my experience, most riggers are very comfortable and happy to teach. So
yeah,
I guess it would
outlier.
Be an anomaly if there was someone who didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
But it would be a red flag for sure.
Yeah, that's excellent. Yeah, and like you said, that's just a good filter to look for and ask it on the front end, so they know what they're getting into, and they might schedule you with a little extra time.
Right.
And that's helpful as well. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode of the On Deck Podcast. I am Sailor Smurf. If you have any questions for us, head over to our YouTube channel, the On Deck channel on YouTube, and you can interact with us there, see all of our content. We have so much great stuff that we're working on putting out. It's just a baby channel in its infancy, but it is slowly growing up as we continue to keep putting our love and attention into it. And once again, if you guys would leave a review for us on whatever, wherever you're getting this podcast, it helps our little podcast get legs and have better reach out into the sailing community. Thank you again for your time. Sailor Smurf out.